thanks to those in Global Impact and those who've been prayerfully supporting me over the last year particularly. Really appreciate it, and had a couple of emails from the Global Impact team. Arrived on the ship at absolutely the perfect time when I needed some encouragement. So thank you very much to those who've been prayerfully supporting, and particularly to the Global Impact team. And thank you to Leon for allowing me to speak tonight. I think old pastors have a bit of a bad smell, really. So to have one back is very gracious of. So I'm incredibly nervous because I haven't actually spoken in a church for over 3 years, I don't think, which just seems crazy. And a big crowd on a warship is 9, so this is a huge crowd. So I'm a bit anxious. Thank you. We just pray before we begin. Father, we thank you for the passage that was just out from the book of Philippians, an extraordinary passage from the apostle. Courage, Lord, to understand its meaning in the ability, Lord, to put it into action. Our prayers, and we seek your God. Now, most of you know that I work for the Royal Australian Navy, and my job is to be a chaplain. When Wendy and I first visited a warship a few years ago, I didn't have my glasses on that day. And we went through this Anzac-class frigate, and I walked past through 3 or 4 cabins, and I saw a welfare officer. I thought, oh, welfare officer, senior welfare officer. And I said to Wendy, this is really impressive. They're really into welfare. She said, put your glasses on. It says warfare. So what the Navy is most about is warfare. The motto of the Navy is to fight and win at sea. So it's about warfare. But my job is about welfare. I'm employed by the Navy to do welfare. And that means to offer pastoral care in the same way that I, as a member of the staff, offered pastoral care here. Also to offer spiritual support. I get involved in all sorts of things in terms of pastoral care and welfare. Also run church on Sunday or Friday or whenever happens to be the time we run church. This is not working. Where are we going to point it at? Ah, there we go. I just thought I'd show you a slide of what church looks like on a warship or an FFG that I'm on. We're in a space about half to a third of the size of the creche. And there's nowhere to sit down, so it has to be a fairly short service. And as I said, a good crowd is 8 or 9. We had about a group of about a dozen who regularly met for worship on the ship that I was on. I've just come back from 7 months on HMAS Darwin. We did what's called an Op Manitou deployment, a Middle East deployment. We've had a ship continually on rotation in the Middle East now for nearly 24 years in the Royal Australian Navy. Going right back before Gulf War I. And I'll explain a little bit about what we did in a little while. But let me just say that some people have asked me, how did the experience of being away for 7 months from family, being on a warship for 7 months, what did that do to my faith? And that's what I thought I'd talk about tonight. But really looking at the passage that Leon asked me to have a look at, the passage in Philippians, which really explains what faith is like in what I would call a tough situation. My 7 months was basically with a crew of 235 agnostics, atheists, and a few people sympathetic to the faith. Of the 10 or 12 who used to come regularly to church, and I was always grateful that anybody came, and one of the ladies, the chief, came. You can see her, she's this lady here. I said to her, Chief Newman, why did you come to church that first Sunday? She said, well, do you want the truth or do you want me to be nice? I said, no, be truthful. And she said, well, I felt sorry for you. I didn't think anybody else would come. Fortunately, she kept coming. But at one stage, I told them the story on the ship of David and Goliath. And of the 12 who came to church that day in 2 services, morning and afternoon, not one of them had heard the story of David and Goliath, which explains a bit about the spiritual maturity of the 200 and something that didn't come. if that makes sense. So what did that do to my faith? Well, one of the things it did to my faith was it reminded me of how far Australians now are from the Lord, how far our culture has now wandered. And I guess while I was a church pastor, maybe I didn't see that as clearly as I certainly see it now. We're going to have fun with this tonight, aren't we? This is basically where we went on the deployment. We started down here in Australia, and we sailed up here. It took us about 6 weeks to get there. It's not a six-week trip, but we had a lot to do on the way. And basically, we spent the first 2 or 3 months of our deployment up in this area called the Makarang Coast. There's a lot of drugs comes from this part of the world down to this part of the world. There's a thing called the Smack Track, and boats come from here down to here, and we were there to intercept them up this end. So we spent the first 2 or 3 months up at this part of the world, and then the last 3 or 4 months right down here, down as far as Madagascar, where the weather's a lot worse, let me tell you. I like this part of the world. So that's basically, we did a number of patrols in that part of the world. There were two statements that were said to me by sailors that really sum up, I think, the faith or lack of it of many Australians. One sailor said to me, and I wasn't hassling him about God or anything, but God comes up when you're at sea and you've got nothing else to talk about. He said to me, "Oh, I don't believe in God." I said, "Oh, why?" And he said, "Because science has answered all the questions." What an amazing statement, isn't it? Another sailor said to me, another great statement, he said to me, "Padre, you think that God will ever make a comeback?" I didn't have a good answer at the time, but afterwards I said to him, 2 days later, I said to him, "Who would have ever thought that colouring in books would become trendy again?" You know, I mean, really, if someone had told me 15 years ago that you could make money out of colouring in books for adults, so who would know? The world that we experienced in Australia may be bleak spiritually, but the world the apostle experienced was far bleaker in the first century. And Paul, one of the leaders of the early church, was in jail in a Roman cell in much worse conditions than I experienced. And it looked like he would end up dying there. The passage that was just read to us, he's facing death. And he must have thought, this Christian thing may well be snuffed out, may well be pushed back into the sea. But the apostle is incredibly positive in this passage. In spite of his difficulties, when belief is tough, I think clearly the first thing that is obvious is that Paul wants to tell us that we need to have faith. We need to have faith in this overhead at the moment. There we go. And the first few verses say, "Now I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel. As a result, it has become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I'm in chains for Christ." Here's Paul in jail at a time where the Christian faith looks like it's about to be extinguished, and he can see this is incredibly positive, that his chains are an advantage. "And because of my chains also, most of the brothers and sisters have become confident in the Lord and dare all the more to proclaim the gospel without fear." Faith can see blessings in spite of chains. Faith can see that God is still at work when the vast majority no longer believe. Faith can see that God is still active when we're in the minority. Faith is a confidence in God's strength when we don't have much of our own. As a Christian chaplain working for the ADF, my job in a sense is, we can get the slide up, my job is to work in a sense behind enemy lines, and I say that spiritually. I wear this uniform so that I look like everybody else, so that I can infiltrate, so that I can be one of the crew. And my job as a pastor is to be able to in a sense infiltrate unbelief. When my job was a pastor of a local church, My job was more to train and equip others to get out in the world, and I've got the task now as a chaplain to be there. But behind enemy lines is probably not a good description. It's not a biblical description. A better one would be the whole word, the word incarnation. As Christ came and dwelt amongst us, my job is to be amongst the crew of a warship at sea. And the sailors and officers, though many, if not most, are unbelievers, are still created in the image of God. They're still loved by God. They're still made for God's purposes. So my job as a chaplain is to listen and to care and to support. Many, many years ago when I first started a ministry, an old minister friend of mine said that ministers are not paid a salary, they're paid a stipend. And the difference, pedantically from him, his point, was that ministers are not paid to work, they're paid to not work. That is, they're paid to be free to minister the gospel. Now, I'm not sure that's true for a senior pastor of a church. As I listen to Leon make the announcements and I think of all the things that are on Leon's plate, because I know, he does a lot. Whereas in the Navy, one rule of a chaplain is I'm allowed to be responsible for nothing, almost. I'm not allowed to have command of anything. I don't really have a job. But I'm paid to be free to minister to people, to care for people, to look after people, to chat with people, to effectively loiter. That's a lot of what we do. So a lot of what I do to fill up a day on a warship, because the days are long and I'm not doing pastoral counselling all day, I volunteer in all sorts of parts of the ship and work. Any sort of area of very little competency where I could actually be of assistance. So the biggest place I work is in the galley. And I would go down for a couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours after every afternoon and help out in the galley. I became the chief carver on HMAS Darwin. And on the trip, I carved over 2 ton of meat. About 20 to 40 kilos of meat every day for 200 days. The galley's a great place to be because it's at the centre of the ship and people come through for food, and I would serve dinner with the Kellick cook as well. I would get involved in all sorts of things we do at sea, evolutions, and I'd find a place when we... Warships run out of fuel after about a week, but we stayed at sea for 3 or 4 weeks, so we have to replenish at sea. What that involves is 2 ships lining up next to each other. There's no petrol stations at sea, by the way. So 2 ships line up. We line up next to a tanker. We steam together at 11 or 12 knots, about 500 yards apart. We fire a gun from one ship to the other ship with a rope, a thin rope, and then they pull across a thick rope, and then a thicker rope, and then an even thicker rope. And eventually we pull in a big prop and we bring the prop in, lock it up with our hole and fuel up. But all that's done quite manually, a lot of pulling of ropes. And it takes 2 to 3 hours and I would be up helping with that in all sorts of ways. So my job in a sense was not to work, but to work and to use the ministry opportunities that come up. Paul says in this passage, as he was in jail, "It is true that some preach Christ out of envy or rivalry, others out of goodwill. The latter do not do so out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defence of the gospel. The former preach Christ out of selfish ambition, not selfishly, supposing that they can stir up trouble for me while I'm in chains. But what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether false motives or true, Christ is preached, and because of this I rejoice." Paul doesn't care why you preach the gospel, how you preach the gospel, even what your motives are, because all of our motives are at best mixed. Paul was just delighted that the gospel was being preached. Faith is necessary. Faith is impressive. Then the word of God needs to be proclaimed even in an age when people don't want to hear. One of the books I read when I was away was this book by Roy Williams called Post-God Nations. Roy Williams is a fascinating guy, an Australian lawyer who came to Christ. And this book is really a book about what's happened to Australia. What's happened to our faith in God in this country? And Williams really, historically, really carefully explains just how much faith has changed. In the Navy, if you're a chaplain during the Second World War, the difference I always say to people is we have PTIs on board our ships, physical training instructors. And their job is to keep the ship fit when we're at sea. And they run PT classes and all sorts of stuff. Now, everybody loves the PTI because everybody on a warship is committed to PT. Not everyone does it. Not everyone is as conscientious as everybody else. But everyone, in theory, is committed to it because that's what we do. And I suspect the chaplain, during the Second World War, had that sort of ministry. Everybody was committed to Christianity. Not everyone did it. Not everyone was enthusiastic. But in theory, everybody was there. Whereas now the chaplain is more an oddity, more a stranger, more an outsider. Roy Williams writes this great book. It's half great. I know Roy Williams, he's a friend of mine, but I haven't actually told him this. I thought the first half of the book was fabulous. The second half of the book's terrible. The first half of the book explains what's gone wrong. The second half, he tries to explain why it happened. And I don't know if any of us know why it's happened. Why has Australia lost its faith? What is it that's led to it? It's happened. In the Australian census, the new one, the figures will come out soon, but the last one, 18% of people said they didn't believe it. They had no religion. In the ADF, Australian Defence Force, when we asked the same question, 50% say they have no religion. Now, it may well be the ADF picks from the godless part of society. I don't think that's the reason. What do you think the other explanation might be? That's exactly... Who said that? Death. Andrew. Age. The ADF is younger than the average population. That's where we're going, folks. That's where our society is going. We're not on a good trajectory at the moment. That's where we're going as a nation. That's why, for believers, we need faith. It's not an easy time to be a believer. That's why, for believers, we need to encourage each other. And Paul, at a far tougher time, could still be a shining light in a Roman cell. He could still hold out his faith richly in spite of his chains. Paul saw the importance of faith and then the importance of hope. And we read in verse 18, For I know that though your prayer, through your prayers, God's provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, what has happened to me, will turn out for my deliverance. I eagerly expect and hope that I will be in no way ashamed, but will have sufficient courage, so that now, as always, Christ will be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I'm to go on living in the body, this will mean fruitful labour. Yet, what shall I choose? I don't know. I'm torn between the two. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. But if it's necessary for me, for you, that I remain in the body, convinced of this, I know that I will remain. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. The most incredible statement of hope. What is the difference between what Paul says there and this quote, if it ever comes up on the screen? Who can give me the full quote? Someone at high school who's just studied Hamlet, or someone who's very old and still remembers it? Who can do it? Someone must be able to do it in this building, surely. Whether is nobler of the mind to sling the... Keep going, thank you. Come on. Hang on, easy. What's the difference between... For to me to live is Christ and to die is gain, and what Hamlet said. What's the difference? What's Hamlet saying? You guys. What's Hamlet saying? You quoted it. What is he saying? What's your name? Philip, what's he saying? It's suicide. It's a suicidal ideation. That's what we'd call it now. He's questioning whether to live or not. But that's not what Paul's saying. Paul's facing death and looks it in the eye and says, well, if I have to die, that's good. That's a gain. That's a bonus. But I'm happy to live if that's service. It's not a suicide ideation, what Paul's saying. It's a statement of hope, a statement of belief. As I said, I was away for 201 days on a warship with 235 young men and women. I have a confession to make. That goes back to when I was the pastor here. When I was the pastor here, we used to run church house parties. Remember them? Still go to them. if any of the staff who worked with me during those years were here tonight, they would agree that I'm finally confessing this out loud. I never liked going on house parties. And I didn't like them because of the creature comforts. I didn't like the communal living. I didn't like the communal meals. I didn't like the squashy rooms. Boy, did God have a sense of humour with me. Let me just show you, if I can. That's my cabin on Warship Darwin. That is the third most luxurious cabin on the ship. The captain has his own cabin. Two of the other senior officers have their own cabin. And I shared the cabin with this gentleman. We're having a bit of a party here, a bit of a cup of tea at the end of the day. That's my rack there, my top bunk. And as you can see, it's not a very big space. And that is luxury compared to most everybody on board. Because the sailors have, the male sailors have a mess space with 66 racks in it, 66 bunks, in a space about as big as the foyer to the wall out there. Maybe a little bit bigger. It's not much, not very big. And they have two showers and two toilets, two heads, and there's no curtains. Whereas where I, the part of the ship I lived in, we had two showers to 25 officers and two toilets. So by contrast, luxury. So, you know, the fact that I used to whinge about church house parties is really a bit of a joke. And we were away for 201 days, and I think I had about 10 or 11 days off in the 200. And the boots would go on at about 6 a.m., 5:30 sometimes, and come off at about 10 o'clock. And again, I'm a slack working, what they call in a ship, a dirty day hand. That is, I'm not a real sailor because I don't work, you know, do watches all night. And the food on board a warship is very good, particularly when we leave port. But after you've been at sea for a week or two or three, it's not quite so good. We don't want that slide yet, actually. We don't have fruit after a few days. The first thing you lose is the fresh milk, and then you go from full cream milk to only the light left, and then the light goes and you're on to long life full cream, and then the long life full cream runs out and you're on long life light. That's really horrible. And as I said, we have very good food, but you don't have little luxuries like cheese or salads or privacy or... And the only privacy you ever have at the end of the day, you can't see my rack here, my rack's just there, but at the end of the day, you get up into that rack, even when this guy's having a meeting in the room, we won't go to that, and you pull the curtain across there, and that's your private space at the end of the day, and that is just beautiful. It's amazing how, and for some poor people on board the ship that don't have a curtain, I always used to feel that is just the saddest thing. At least when you close that curtain at the end of the day, you had a little bit of privacy. But for me, that wasn't the hardest part about being on a warship. The hardest part, I think, was, and if we get the next slide up, being exposed to what I would call the fruits of unbelief. Because much of the fruit that goes with unbelief is not pleasant. And a lot of the issues and drama we had on board the ship is just the fruit of unbelief. I remember saying to one of the sailors, we were in Muscat in Oman, and a lot of the sailors were going to stay at a very fancy hotel, the Shangri-La, and I went and stayed in this $90 a night place in town, which is quite nice, called the Rui. We had a couple of nights off. And I said to the sailor, he said to me, why aren't you going to the Shangri-La? And I said, what's the point of going to a flash hotel when my wife is not there to enjoy it with me? And he looked at me and he just said, sir, you've got the wrong idea. It's exactly the time to enjoy it when your missus is not there. And the other thing that was challenging was dealing with, in the Middle East, when we're alongside at least, dealing with the legalism of Islam. And Islam is a tough religion in many ways, and we were in not by any means the toughest part of the world in terms of Islam. But it's legalistic with an incredible underbelly of hypocrisy. We stayed a couple of times in Bahrain, and I stayed at the most distinguished residence in Bahrain. It actually wasn't, but that's what the sign said. But Bahrain is a little island off the coast of Saudi Arabia. And Bahrain is the place where lots of people come to do things that they can't do in Saudi Arabia. Because when your religion is very legalistic, then you make up rules that get around the rules. So they have a saying in Bahrain that is, Bahrain's called, known as the Pearl. It used to be a pearl monument. And a local told me, oh, there's a saying, Allah can't see into the pool. Allah isn't able to see into the pool. So alcohol, which is illegal in Saudi Arabia, is very legal in Bahrain, and prostitution and gambling and a whole lot of other stuff. But Paul says, for me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. Paul could see that his faith was filled with hope, hope at what would go on in the future. But in the meantime, it also involves struggle. Paul says in verse 27, whatever happens, conduct yourself in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Then whether I come and see you or only hear about you in my absence, I will know that you stand firm in one spirit, striving together as one for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. This is a sign of them that will be destroyed, but you, that you will be saved, and that by God. For it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for him, since you are going through the same struggle you saw I had, and now hear that I still have. Paul says that he says there clearly, whatever happens, conduct yourself in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. In an age of unbelief, in an age of increasing unbelief, a Christian's ability to conduct themselves in a manner of worthy of Christ is absolutely more crucial than ever. As a chaplain in the Navy, I benefit from something incredible. I benefit from 100 years of faithful service of chaplains in peacetime and in wartime. And chaplains have died in POW camps, and chaplains have died at sea as the rest of the crew have perished. And that heritage gives me as a chaplain a great deal of openness and open doors that I don't deserve, but because of the conduct and the manner worthy of the gospel of Christ of those who've gone before me, those doors are still being opened. However, on the other hand, a sailor said to me one day, Padre, we think you are different from most other ministers. How's that, Ben? We're pretty sure you're not a paedophile. No, that's what he said. Now, he's a 21-year-old guy who's grown up in a world where ministers of religion are paedophiles. That's what he hears all the time in the news. He hasn't made that up. He hasn't invented that. That's his experience. I saw a survey the other day, and it was a survey of my lifetime in ministry. In 1985, 85% of people in Australia thought ministers of religion were trustworthy, and now it's below 15%. That's not the world's fault. That's our fault. In an age where things are tough, what we do is so much more important. That's why Paul realized it was a struggle that we need to be part of. See, we live in a world where there's so much wrong. You may have, if you followed our time away, you may have heard something of some of the things we did overseas, but one of the things we did was we found this cache of weapons on a dhow. There are 2,000 AK-47s. There's a whole bunch of mortar things and anti-aircraft rockets. I helped load these off the ship. I never thought in my lifetime I'd load 2,000 AK-47s. It was fascinating loading them because a lot of them were old, and a lot of them they'd been sort of fixed up over the years. You could see they had a bit of this and a bit of that. And I thought if I could write a novel, you could make up a story of where one of these weapons had been for the last 40 years maybe, and what parts of the world it had killed people. But our guys and girls found these on a dhow after 20 hours on board this ship looking for it. And they ended up moving about a ton and a half of fishing nets, and then they found it underneath. If anybody wants to do anything good in the world, it's a struggle. The other big event that happened on our trip was that we found three considerably large stashes of heroin. Over 900 kilograms of heroin we found on three ships, three boats, three dhows. Again, the struggle for the guys and girls who did that, each time over 20 hours before they discovered anything. The first lot they discovered in an ice hole, what should have been, well, underneath the ice was a false floor, like the boat looked like a fishing boat. It had a big tub, that, you know, big tank of ice. And what they discovered when they got rid of all the ice was it had a fake floor, and it was underneath the fake floor. And the other lot they found was in the back of a fuel tank. So they had to empty the fuel tank, get into the fuel tank, get through the false wall at the back of the fuel tank, and found the heroin on the other side of the fuel tank. To do anything worthwhile in this world involves struggle. How much more to honour Christ with our lives? Is it going to require struggle? The two things that have toughened me up in life was firstly marrying Wendy. When I married Wendy, she told me the phrase, hard dogs for hard roads, puppies on the footpath. And she didn't want to be married to a puppy. And the Navy, they just say to you things like, lovingly, they say to you things like, toughen up, princess. But my faith is nowhere near as tough. And my experience is nowhere near as tough as the experience of the Apostle Paul, who was in chains. And if we had him here tonight, what would he say? That his experience was nothing compared to the suffering of our Lord and the struggle of our Lord who shed his blood on the cross. We need to struggle and pray and wait. We have to get used to the fact that we live in a country where our faith is in the minority, and I suspect we'll get so more and more. But we continue to struggle and wait upon the Lord for our opportunities. We got to Muscat towards the end of our fifth patrol. Muscat's in Oman. It's quite a lovely city, lovely place. And we'd had a tough 6 or 8 weeks. We'd had a patrol around Tanzania. We went to Tanzania for a rest. We weren't allowed... A 4-day visit was turned into a 2-day visit. They wouldn't let us stay overnight. They virtually hardly let us off the ship. So what should have been a fairly short patrol ended up being a very, very long patrol. And we finally got some time off and we got to Muscat. And I had a hotel booked. And it was the first time I've been off the ship for some weeks. And I got into my hotel in Muscat and I went into town and I bought some food and it was just lovely. I got back to my hotel. I was just about to organised this food and my work phone rang and it was the officer of the day. And he said, Padre, you've got to be back on the ship. Now, we're all on ready to be recalled at any time. But my immediate response was, you've got to be joking. What do you mean be back on the ship? How quickly? Now. So I knew this guy, so I said, what's going on? He said, don't ask questions, Padre. The captain wants you personally back on the ship immediately. Get in a taxi, get here. Now, it's not going to be good when the chaplain's asked to come back to the ship that quickly. And it wasn't good. And some of you may have read about it again in the papers. Because in Oman, one of our sailors died. A young 27-year-old... Oh, there it is. You can read it yourself. 27-year-old sailor died. In a hotel room in Oman. And he was the galley manager. He was the cook who was in charge of our galley. So I knew him very, very well, as did the captain. It was a tragic, tragic accident of this young man's life. He died in a hotel room. And all of a sudden, the chaplain, who was an effective loiterer, all of a sudden became a lot more important. As people still aren't very good at dealing with death, and particularly death of young people. And we had a very difficult few days in Oman, where firstly we had to tell the crew that this guy had died, the captain told them, And then we had to get his body out of Oman in a hurry. And we had to have a ramp, so we wanted to have a ramp ceremony on an airbase in Oman, which Oman's not an ally of Australia. It's just very tricky in the middle of Ramadan, which is even more tricky, and at 48 degree temperature. But God answered some of your prayers that you didn't even know what you were praying for those days. And God opened opportunities, and those opportunities are still being opened. The crew are still, the grief is still very real. It's not that long ago this happened. It's still very real. And we need to struggle and we need to pray that God will open the doors that we can never open ourselves. For Paul, by conclusion, faith, hope and struggle. Do you know, my time away, amongst other things, reminded me of two things by way of conclusion. Is there another one before then? Leave that one. Firstly, we see all the worst side of the Middle East all the time on the telly, but there's so many wonderful parts of the Middle East. And I loved seeing in Oman. We see the men and the women in Oman. Not only the women had these beautiful black robes and scarves, but absolutely elegant and beautiful. And the men were in the white robes, and they looked magnificent. The beautiful children with Oman's just this place where they obviously treasure their children, and the family life was, you just see it in the streets. It was just absolutely gorgeous. Dubai, I love being in Dubai. It's a crazy, ridiculous, crazy place. We went to the Seychelles, and in the Seychelles, they greeted us like war heroes, because one of the jobs we were doing was keeping the pirates at bay. Not that we did anything, it's just our presence. And for nearly 5 years, the Seychelles weren't able to get any cruise ships into the Seychelles because of the pirates in off Africa. And now, because the pirates have gone, the cruise ships are back. So we were treated like royalty when we got to the Seychelles. However, I'm also reminded on the trip just how fragile the peace that Di prayed about tonight is. We began our trip with a sail up through the disputed passages up in the South China Sea, the Spratly Islands. And it was fortunately a very an uneventful trip. But we also sailed a number of times, if I can get this slide up, up into the Persian Gulf through this little part here called the Straits of Hormuz. And the Straits of Hormuz, again, it's an incredibly beautiful part of the world. You have Oman on this side with this beautiful rocky coastline, and Iran on this side. And as you sail up through here, it's about 2 miles wide, 2 nautical miles wide, and to then get up into the Persian Gulf. And the Iranians don't want people sailing through here. They consider it their part of the world, and if the coalition of naval forces that operated there stopped running through here, these straits would be closed. So when we sailed up here a number of times, we were harassed. And we were harassed by a group. The Iranians have a navy, and then they have the Ayatollah's navy. ISRG, they're called. And it wasn't the navy that was harassing, it was the ISRG. This is the gunboats that the Ayatollah has. And these gunboats would come at us at speed, manned, armed, and a number of times we went to action stations. Now, it didn't come to anything. But it could come to anything very quickly. And the ship's sailing up and down here all the time, and there's tension all the time, and you don't read about this, you don't know about this, fortunately. But the world's full of tension. The world is full of good, and the world is full of tension. And that's why we need to be a people of faith and of hope and of struggle. Questions, comments, thoughts, queries, and then I'll pray. Cara. My daily Bible reading and prayer and my own reading was really important. I fortunately had a little desk, fold-out desk thing, and Wendy taught me to buy this little IKEA chair. And so my fold-out desk and my fold-out IKEA chair was the place I would have my quiet times. My cabin mate said to me the first day, "What is this?" I said, "This is a time where I'd read the Bible and pray." Oh, for crying out loud. But then by the end of the trip, he was asking me to pray for things. So, but that's really important. It's always important, but even more so important. I would often go up on the bridge late in the afternoon up here and see the sunset or see the moon. It's funny, you can be able to worship for days and never go outside because all the work's inside. But I would sort of go out at night, and the sea's incredibly beautiful and when it's calm. And I don't know if it's that much different to being at home. I don't know, less distraction, more time. But for me, just those. I was talking to an Anglican guy, an Anglican chaplain, who Sydney Diocese and doesn't normally use the prayer book, but he uses it at sea. He likes that discipline of the Anglican prayer service or whatever. So it's the disciplines of our spiritual life become really important, I think. That's what all the great saints have said through the centuries, and it's those spiritual disciplines. So. Yes, Hyun? Yeah, pretty good. I mean, we have email at sea, and we have internet of sorts. The email is pretty good, and the internet is pretty good most of the time, except you can't access a whole lot of things like Gmail or Facebook or a whole lot of 90% of the website, really, the web, really. But we have a sat phone. And the sat phone on the ship worked pretty well, so I could ring Wendy, which was nice. The junior sailors have Wi-Fi, but it's pretty hopeless. And unless you're very good at telephones and Wi-Fi, like all our juniors are, I didn't ever bother. It wasn't worth the effort. So in one sense, compared to 30 years ago when you would have had a letter once every few months, fantastic. But then sometimes I think the added communication makes it harder. I would have a lot of time with sailors who would ring home and their wife had got three or four kids and they'd get a 20-minute earful from their wife. And so then I'd get a 20-minute earful from the sailor dealing with the pain from the wife. So, you know, the communications are pretty good, really. There were plenty of times, however, we go black for days. So we go to what's called Jupiter State 4 or whatever. So we go black for days for security reasons. So when we had the death, when we had those big, the drug hauls and that, we'd go silent for 4 or 5 days to stop the message getting out. So that's harder when you don't have any contacts. So. Possibly not. The Chaplain's Branch talks about that. We could get pushed back into the sea, I reckon. However, we do what sustains us, I think, is that most of the chaplains approach chaplaincy with a Christian ministry service heart. So we have all these welfare organisations in defence now, and the defence spends a fortune on them, and they've had all these hotlines and all this. But you ring a lot of these hotlines, and they won't do anything on the weekend. They'll ring the chaplain's branch. So we have all these fancy-dancy hotlines with, you know, wonderfully trained psychologists who work 9 to 5. But if something happens the rest of the time, they'll ring the chaplain's branch. So there is a sense, but who knows? You could get a minister of defence or a chief of defence and we could be gone tomorrow. It's not a big amount of money in defence's budget, I don't think. And we still have a lot of residual goodwill. And as I'm being nice, I'm the only person consistently being nice to people on board. So, no wonder you get liked. But you're right. It's not. We shouldn't assume it'll be there tomorrow. Jim? Yeah. We didn't have it on our ship, but the Navy has just appointed the first Muslim chaplain. They've appointed a Muslim to the senior, like what's called the Religious Advisory Committee, an imam, and they're trying to get a Muslim part-time reservist Navy chaplain. In the Middle East, I met an American Muslim chaplain, and it was interesting. He basically did pastoral care for all, but then sort of spiritual support for just Muslims. On a French ship that we worked in company with, a French aircraft carrier, they had two chaplains on board. They had 4,000 people on board, two chaplains, one Catholic, one Muslim, because they had 40% of their ship Muslim, because the French have got a much bigger percentage of Muslims in their country, and the defence tends to draw from the poorer parts of society. And so, what's the challenge for us in defence is that, so we didn't have any others of other faiths on board our ship. I have dealt with some people, and what my job as a chaplain is to put them in touch with their faith supports. So if there was a Muslim, I would try and find faith support for him, if that made sense. That would be my responsibility as a chaplain. So, but it's going to be more of an issue going in the future. So, yeah, Dion. That's a very good question. You keep going. Okay. The biggest thing, and I actually had the line in my notes, and I left it out because I thought it might sound a bit esoteric, but I think I'd be way more committed to incarnational ministry rather than invitational ministry. What I mean by that is, like, I think in many ways the model I worked on was, you know, invite your friends to church and we'll, you know, reach out to them. Well, there's no point inviting any of my native friends to this church. They wouldn't come. They wouldn't think about coming. I've got to get out and reach them. And I think that's the only change, I think, Dion, is that I think that my experience as a chaplain, I want to be more out there. I'd want to be looking at ways me and as a church we could be much more engaged. I think we've got to earn our way back with service and pray for opportunities rather than go door knocking and, you know, want to say, hello, I want to talk to you about Jesus. I think you probably know more about that than me. I think I probably could, you know, get you to explain. I think that would be the difference. I think I'm much more aware of the fact that it would be silly to try and invite my native friends here because they just would look at me as if to go. It's not a matter of them just waiting for an invitation. David?
But if we...
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, but... Yes. Yes. Yes, but you have to remember the strategy is not like... We're trying to do something impossible. So it has to be a divinely led strategy. It has to be a divine... It's not just a matter of our activity. It's a matter of us praying and seeking the Lord for how to do it. And I you know, flippantly said it to Dion, but we need to talk to people who've lived in even more hostile environments than ours and ask them how they reached out in a place where it was maybe you get thrown in jail for saying anything or something like that. So I think that you're right, there needs to be strategy, but I think we shouldn't beat ourselves up. I was away and one of the things I got was the presbytery minutes, and they were beating up on one particular church for being in decline. And I read this report and I thought, nah, they've missed the point. That church is in decline because it's just mirroring society. It's not doing very well, that church, but no one else is really. There's a few churches doing better than average, but it's a tough place to be at the moment. Whereas we beat up on one Presbyterian church for saying, oh, you know, why are you in such terminal decline? Well, hello, this is the world we now live in. Once upon a time, you put a sign at the front, Presbyterian Church, and Presbyterians, hello, would come. They're not coming now. So we do need to reinvent ourselves. I totally agree. Last one. We're heading back to sea on Friday, and because we were away for such a big part of the year, and we were originally not going to be going to sea at this time of the year, and certainly not going for 6 weeks, the crew don't want to go. I don't want to go. Captain doesn't want to go. but we all signed a piece of paper saying we'd do what we're told. So that'd be the prayer at the moment. It's just that we've had a lot of people who've found medical reasons over the last few weeks why they're not coming. And that's discouraging to those who are still going. So we've just got to sort of get up. And so that'll be my prayer, is just the next 6 weeks. We've got an easy trip compared to this half of the year, but it sort of accumulates, if that makes sense. When I say this half the year, the ship took 7 months preparing for this last 2015, so it's been a tough couple of years, so that'll be the prayer point at the moment. So let me just pray, and then the band will come up and lead us in our final song.